Namaste Saraswati Devi. Gauravani Pacharani Nivasesa Sanyavadi Paskatyade Satarane Vandeham Shri Guru. Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Cha Shri Rupam Sagraja Tam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitams Tam Sajivam Sadvoitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamsha Panchakalpa Trubhischa Kripa Sindhu Vyeva Cha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namo Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. December 18th, 2015, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 8, Manifestation of Brahma from Garbhadakshay Vishnu, Text 18. Kaesha yosavaham abjiprista etat kuto vajjam ananyadapsu asti yadastadiha kinchanaitad adhistitam yatra satanubhavyam.
Kaha, who? Eshaha, this. Yaha asau aham, that I am. Abja priste, on top of the lotus. Etat,
etat,
this. Kutaha, where from? Va, either. Abjam, lotus flower. Ananyat, otherwise. Apsu, in the water. Asti, there is.
There.
He, certainly. Ahastat, from below. Iha, in this. Kinchana, anything. Etat, this. Adistitam, situated. Yatra, wherein. Sata, automatically. New, or not. Bhavyam, must be. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Lord Brahma, in his ignorance, contemplated, who am I that am situated on the top of this lotus? Wherefrom has it sprouted? There must be something downwards, and that from which this lotus has grown must be within the water. Purport. The subject matter of the speculations of Brahma in the beginning regarding the creation of the cosmic manifestation is still a subject matter for mental speculators. The most intelligent man is he who tries to find the cause of his personal existence and that of the whole cosmic creation, and thus tries to find the ultimate cause. If his attempt is properly executed with penances and perseverance, it is sure to be crowned with success. Kaesha yosavaham abjaprista etat kuto vajjam ananyanapsu asti yatastad iha kinchanaitad adistitam yatra satanubhayam. Lord Brahma, in his ignorance, contemplated, who am I that am situated on the top of this lotus? Wherefrom has it sprouted? There must be something downwards, and that from which this lotus has grown must be within the water. So here Prabhupada's saying this is the right question to ask, and he's telling us the right method to find the answer. Now, Prabhupada often says that the world is full of questions and answers. Even the animals are asking questions. And generally the animals are asking, where is food? Oh, it's over here. Where can I find a mate? Oh, my mate is singing or dancing over here. Where is there an enemy? Where is there shelter? Where can I sleep for the night? Those are the questions the animals are asking. They're not generally asking anything more than that, right? Even animals who have a sophisticated communication system, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. And the human beings are also asking questions, and if those are our only questions, then what is the point of our life? And we find, in fact, that most human beings, most of, you know, art, philosophy, etc., is just dedicated to this. How can I eat better, sleep better, mate better, defend better? And this is people's whole topic for conversation. The politicians are simply talking about, we will get you better eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. We'll help your economic situation.
will protect you from enemies. This is, will preserve your right to mate with whomever you want. This is their platform. They don't really go beyond eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. But the real question that demarcates human life is, who am I? Where did everything come from, right? The animal can't ask this question. The little lizard that peeked out from behind a painting this morning when I got up, it can't ask that question. Who am I, anyway? The lizard doesn't even have a sense that I'm a lizard. It's not defining its existence. Where does everything come from? Why am I suffering? Why is this happening to me? Right? When we're suffering, we want to know why. What is the purpose? We want to find some meaning behind things. So these are the right questions to be asking. Of course, we also have to take care of our eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. It's not that we don't eat or sleep if we're a spiritual person. But that should not be our primary question. Our primary question is, who am I? What is my identity? I mean, of course, people do ask that question in a materialistic sense. Who am I as far as, what, in terms of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending? What's the right career for me? Who's a compatible person for me to marry? I mean, those are questions based on who am I, but they're still within the animal range. But who am I ultimately? Who am I? Because unless we answer this question, who am I, how can we do anything else? So we're going to look at these two questions. Who am I? What is the base of everything? What's the basis for which everything has come? I mean, I'm not sitting on a lotus flower. I'm sitting on a chair. But my chair is sitting on the floor. The floor is sitting on the earth. What's the earth resting on? What's the universe resting on? What's the basis? And how do we find the answers to these questions? Prabhupada says these questions are still the subject matter for mental speculators. Do we just guess? What do we do? And Prabhupada's saying two means of finding the answers, penances and perseverance. Some nice alliteration there. So we're going to look at that. Penances and perseverance. Sounds like some motto, our motto, penance and perseverance. So who am I? Why is that an important question to ask? I mean, why can't we just go through life without really defining our identity, or without defining our identity beyond the body? I think we can say that a large number, I mean, I don't know if there's any studies, but a large number of human beings define their identity simply in the way that conventionally their family and friends and school and society define it. You are so-and-so's child. You belong to such-and-such a religion by birth. You belong to such-and-such a nationality by birth. So the body and the circumstances of birth. What piece of land were you on? Were you born on this side of the imaginary line of the border or that side of the imaginary line of the border? If you're born on this side, then you're Hungarian. You're born on the other side, then you're Slovakian, and so forth. By what language your parents speak, your mother tongue, by what food they eat, by how they pray, the color of one's skin, the texture of one's hair. And these things end up defining us, and they form our identity. Well, why should we look beyond that? That's enough, right? They say, I'm a black woman from Greece. Who's an Eastern Orthodox Christian. I mean, isn't that enough? Isn't that enough? And the Vedas say, no, it's not enough, because none of that has to do with the real self. And who we define ourselves as controls every other choice in our life. And I make this point frequently, that all the decisions we make in life, every single one of them, is based upon our definition of who we are, our sense of identity. Every single choice. We may think, I'm making a choice by looking at pros and cons. but we're looking at pros and cons in the context of our identity. Basically, the way that we decide everything is we have an idealized identity based on the different definitions we've given ourselves. Okay, I'm a woman. What does an ideal woman do? Not only I'm a woman, I'm a daughter. What does a good daughter do? What does a good wife do? What does a good mother do? What does a good sister do? You know, I'm Slovakian. What does a good Slovak do? You know, or I'm conservative. What does a good conservative do? I'm, you know, a Jehovah's Witness. What does a good Jehovah's Witness do? We have a definition of ourselves. I am this kind of a person. Then we take the idealized form of that person and we ask ourselves, what would the idealized form of that identity do in this situation? And that defines our pro. That defines our positive thing. Now, you could say that that's our definition of our dharma. That's how we define our dharma. Prabhupada would define dharma as identity. Say the dharma of sugar is to be sweet. The dharma of salt is to be salty. Of a chili pepper is to be pungent, to be burning. You know, if you eat a chili pepper and it's not burning, then it's useless. There's no point in it. Right? So everything's based on that. How we define if my life is good or not. How we define happiness and distress. If I'm a married person, okay, what is an ideal married person's life like? Is my life like that? Does it match? Oh, if it matches, then I'm happy. If it doesn't match, oh, I'm not happy. I'm a parent, so what's the ideal parent-child relationship? Do I have that? So we're always comparing ourselves to the ideal, and in that way we're determining what we should do, we're determining whether or not we've achieved our goals, we're calculating whether or not we're successful, whether or not we're happy, and so forth and so on. So finding out who we are is crucial. Absolutely crucial. It will change everything. Right? It will change everything. We see that when people change their identity, their actions change. It can become opposite. You know, there's a lot of talk about Westerners who become radicalized Muslims. And then they change their behavior. They'll bomb the persons with whom they grew up because they don't identify with them anymore. They identify with somebody else. Now I'm a radicalized Muslim and I grew up in a Christian family, so I can bomb the Christians. If you identify with that, you wouldn't do that. It changes everything. When people go into the military, the main thing they do is try to change their identity. When you go to a college, a university, they try to give you an identity, even most secondary schools. Not so much in primary, but secondary college. You get an identity. You have, you know, certain colors of your school or your country, a flag, a motto, a mascot, a certain persona that's associated with your particular school, a certain mood. Well, we go to this school and therefore we are artists. We go to this school, therefore we are intellectuals. Our identities are constantly trying to be shaped. You know, what is by everybody. The advertisers know if they can shape your identity, they can shape your purchases. I like to tell the story. I was visiting a family once. They had just recently bought a house, and they had a small table. And the father said to me, "Well, people accept that when you've just moved into a house, the table where you eat will be small, but once you've lived there for a couple years, they're going to expect you to have a bigger dining room table." Yeah, so this person was identifying, I'm a middle-class American, and this is what middle-class Americans should buy. What products should they have in their house? And the advertisers will promote, you know, if you're this kind of person, you'll have this kind of product. And then people go out and buy it. So this is an essential question. Who am I? Changes everything. It changes how do I define what is a successful life. It changes how I define happiness. It changes every decision I make at every moment. Do I get out of bed at 4 o'clock or at 7 o'clock? What do I do when I get out of bed? What do I eat? How do I speak to the people around me? How do I treat them? If being dishonest will get me more money or more prestige, do I do it or not? All of this is based on identity. And then asking the question, what is the base? What is the base? Where did everything come from? Now, why is that question important? Why is that question important? Because that's directly related also to my identity. You'll notice that all of our material identities are in relationship. I'm part of this family. I'm part of this society. I'm part of this community. It's all in relationship to some whole that's bigger than myself. I'm part of a religion. So if I don't know, if I don't have the correct whole, then I can't have the correct part. Of course, it's interesting that Srila Prabhupada said, first thing you should preach to people is that I'm not this body, and then preach to them that there is a God. I'm not this body. Well, then, I know some devotees have told me that they said this to people, you know, you're not that body. And then, well, whose body am I? Because then that immediately, you immediately want to ask that question. Because we're self-centered, it's good to start with ourselves. I'm not this body. I'm not a man. I'm not a woman. I'm not old. I'm not young. I'm not an American. I'm not a Peruvian. I'm not a conservative or a liberal or a Catholic or Muslim. I'm not any. Well, then what am I? What group? Then we long to ask that question. What is the whole that I'm a part? If you bring that up first, people aren't so interested. I'm a French Roman Catholic man. Why do I care if there's a God? And how is that relevant to my life? What's relevant to my life is who's going to be the president of my country and what goes on in my family. That's relevant to my life. So first I have to ask the question, who am I? And then I'm going to be interested in knowing what's the whole of which I'm a part. Where did everything come from? Where do I get my shelter? To where do I connect my identity? What's the overall purpose? You know, I can only determine my individual purpose within the overall purpose. If I'm an American, then one of the overall purposes of America is to promote democracy and freedom. And then that becomes my purpose. Right? So if I know, wait a minute, I'm a spiritual being. What's my purpose? What's my goal? And then I have to look at what is the overall goal. What's the purpose of creation? Why does creation exist? As Prabhupada was asked, why is there anything? Why does anything exist at all? Where does it come from? What is the purpose of the creator? What is the purpose of the foundation? You know, we as little living beings, when we create something, it is with some purpose. So that's the next big important question. Again, without which we can't take a step forward. We are, all of us, indirectly, perhaps unknowingly, asking and answering these questions at every moment. We are making an assumption about who am I and what is the base. If we don't ask these questions explicitly, then we're running on some kind of automatic pilot. And we're running on some kind of track that somebody else designed for us without really asking if it's the right one. You know, we find out once we get to the benchmarks that something is wrong. If we have the wrong identity and the wrong base, then we don't understand why we achieve the goals of that wrong identity and wrong base, and they fail to get us satisfaction. They fail to deliver. They call it overpromise and underdeliver. Right, you buy the thing, you work for the cause, and you're simply disappointed. I gave my whole life to my country, to my family, to my sports team, to whatever it may be, to my work. People will say, you know, well, have a career that will satisfy you. No. Put your career second. Give your love to your family. Otherwise, you'll regret at your deathbed. You work too much. No. Give yourself to a higher cause than your family. Work for the good of mankind. No, work for the good of all living entities. Prabhupada says in the Nectar of Devotion preface, our love is expanding, but we're not satisfied. So if we don't ask these questions explicitly, we're asking them implicitly. Right? Practically every human child asks the question at a young age, where did I come from? And then the parents usually just answer with some direct or indirect answer about sex. That doesn't really answer the question, does it? So we are asking this question. We are basing our life on whatever we think are the answers to this question. These two questions, really. Who am I? And what is the whole of which I am a part? But how are we going to find the answers to these questions? They're pretty important questions. They are the important questions. How are we going to find the answers? Prabhupada says here that the mental speculators are continuing to ask this. Well, maybe I'm this, maybe I'm that. Do I have any identity? You know, there's a form of Buddhism becoming very popular in the West. There's many forms of Buddhism, by the way. But the form that's becoming very popular is that I have no identity. My only identity, what I'm calling my identity, is simply bodily and mental sensations, which are changing at every moment, like a river. A river has no identity. The water in the river at any particular spot is constantly changing. Therefore, one cannot say that the river has any real existence in and of itself. And in the same way, our sense of self has no continuance. This concept of an identity doesn't exist. So they speculate like that. Or others say, well, we have just an identity according to the mind or an identity according to the body. So they speculate in so many ways. Or what is the base of everything? The base of everything is random explosions and mutations. The base of everything is a vengeful, angry God who tried to create a good world and messed up on it. And it's taking a few thousand years to figure out how to fix it. Now, what is the base of it? So how are we going to find this out? Just speculating and guessing? Well, we can get some things right. We'll get some things right and we'll get some things wrong. And as I bring up many times, we won't know what we get right and we get wrong. We might have played the game as a child where child number one hides an object and child number two searches for it. And child number one will say, you're getting warmer, you're getting colder, you're getting warmer, you're getting hot, you're getting really cold, as we get closer and further from the object. But there's no voice from the sky like that, right? If I'm speculating, who am I? If I'm speculating, what is my base? There's no voice from the sky going, you're getting warmer, you're getting colder, right? So I don't know. And how many times just in our individual, daily, little, petty questions of life do we say, I found the answer, and we do it, and it's a failure? Or, you know, well, that won't work. And then it gets done anyway, and we go, wow, I was wrong, that did work. So if we're just speculating to find these answers, we won't even know when we're getting close. We may be, you know, a millimeter away from the answer, and then say, the answer's not here, and divert to something else, and just miss it. Like the people who go to the Brahman and then they miss Bhagavan. Or we may be, you know, on the other end of the truth and think we have it and dedicate lifetimes to some opposite conception. So here Prabhupada is saying penance and perseverance, which is what, of course, is being demonstrated by Lord Brahma in the story that as we progress in the section, he's told tapa, penance. And perseverance, he had to perform austerity penance for 1,000 celestial years, an inconceivable amount of time. And when the Lord comes, he says to Lord Brahma, penance is my life and soul. Penance is everything. I am tapasya. I am penance. Tapasa ridayam sakshat atmaham tapaso naga. He says to Lord Mahan. Tapasa ridayam sakshat tapasya, which is a little different than penance, but similar. Tapasya, austerity. Ridayam sakshat is my very heart. Atmaham tapaso. Atma aham. I, myself, am tapasya. So why penance? Why penance? Krishna tells Lord Brahma, I create, maintain, and dissolve everything by penance only. So tapasya, is an interesting word. We'll look first at tapasya, because although Prabhupada uses the word penance here, Lord Brahma is told tapa, which has a slightly different meaning of austerity. Tapa means heat. It also means suffering. If you break your leg, that's a tapa. And it means involuntary suffering, or in this context, voluntary suffering. So something that's burning, a voluntary suffering that's burning and illuminating. So why? Or penance. Penance means a particular kind of austerity. So someone may go through austerity. Let's say somebody wants to become very rich. So they may undertake some austerity to become rich. They may go to school for 12 years to get an advanced degree, and then they may get a job where they have to work very hard, put in long hours, 80 hours a week, 100 hours a week. So they may put in some austerity like that, but that's not penance. The austerity of penance is, I've done something wrong, and I take some personal austerity to show that I am apologetic. All right, when somebody harms us, we don't just want an I'm sorry. We want an I'm sorry coupled with some kind of penance. We want to perceive that the other person has some sort of rectification. I won't do it again. That's a kind of penance. Just even connecting with our hurt feelings is a kind of penance. Oh, I've hurt you so much. And they feel our pain to some extent. That's a kind of penance. Fixing it at the, oh, I broke the vase, I'll glue it. Or I'll buy you a new one. Right? We want them to fix the harm if it's fixable. If it's not fixable, at least we want them not to commit the harm again. We want some empathy and understanding, which will entail that they feel our pain to some extent. So all of those are penance. They are all voluntary, painful, difficult situation that a person undergoes as a way of fixing or rectifying some harm that they did. So when we understand penance in that way, it becomes rather obvious why penance is necessary to get the answers to these questions. Indeed, without some sort of penance, getting the answers to these questions, we can say, is completely impossible. The reason being that without letting go of our false identity, we cannot find our real identity. Now, in whatever order that happens, and it generally happens a little bit each way. So you let go of your false identity and take on the real identity, or start taking on the real identity and let go of the false identity. It might start with the positive. Oh, I'm a spirit soul. And as soon as you say that, part of the false I am has to fall away. Oh, the basis is a personal God. Then part of the false idea that the basis is an exploding chunk has to fall away. They can't coexist. I can't say I'm a spirit soul and I'm also, you know, a male Spaniard. They can't. They're incompatible. So the real penance is letting go of what we call the false ego, the ahankara. That is the ultimate penance. And any other penance, like we have our penance of no illicit sex, no meat eating, no intoxication, no gambling. That's meant simply to aid us in letting go of this false identity. I am this, I am that. And the basis of the fall, if you go down, if you keep going down to the root of the false identity, right, the top layers of the false identity are things like karma and gyan, bhukti and mukti. I want to enjoy sense pleasures and I want liberation from sense pain. That's kind of at the top. You know, I want a heavenly situation and I want to avoid a hellish situation. Then the next layer under, you're getting to things like lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion that are pushing all of those. And the next layer you're getting under that is deceit and pretense. In order to get those things, I pretend to be something that I'm not. I accept this false identity. I pretend to be a better person than I am. And all the way at the bottom is the desire for fame and honor, the desire to be the center, the desire to be the most important person in the universe. This deep pride, what ordinary people call egoism, egotistical narcissistic. So that's the very root from this narcissism. I am great, I am wonderful, I am the center, everybody notice how great and wonderful I am, comes pretense. From pretense causes comes lust, anger, envy, greed, illusion. From lust, anger, envy, greed, illusion come the desires for heavenly sense pleasure and the desire for liberation from suffering. So the penance is to get rid of that. That's the penance. And all of the, you know, fasting on certain days, eating only certain food, all the difficulties that are prescribed. Sitting in, I mean, what was Lord Brahma's tapasya? Sitting and meditating on the Lord. All of those are meant ultimately to have us do the real penance of letting go of the false ego. If you think about our human relationships, right? Our human relationships, when we have a discord between each other, what's the only way to solve it? The only way to solve it is for one or both persons involved to back down from their ego. Isn't it a fact? Somebody has to give up the concept that I am the center and I am right and you are wrong. And instead, to do the penance of connecting with the other person. That's the ultimate penance. So without that, we cannot find their identity. Impossible. Impossible. Anyone who thinks, you know, I'm going to maintain my ahankara, I'm going to maintain my pride, you know, it cannot be done. Therefore, Krishna says the first thing in the process of knowledge is humility. First thing, Raghunath Das Goswami, dambam hitva, give up pride. One has to start with that at least at some level. And perseverance, well, that's sort of self-explanatory. That one should not expect that when I undergo penance, it's going to be instant, especially if the problem has been very long in duration. Right? You go to see a doctor and they'll tell you, if you got this disease yesterday, we can cure it pretty easily. But if you've had the disease for 3 years, you know it's going to take longer. And if you've had the disease for 30 years, it's going to take longer. It's just what it is. You know, if I have a good relationship with you and I mess it up and then I fix it in 5 minutes, it's pretty easy to fix. But if I've been messing up my relationship with you for years, I mean, there are people in my life who cheated me and lied to me and hurt me for decades. If they just come to me and say, oh, Armila, I'm sorry, I want a relationship back with you, I'm going to be guarded. It's going to take some time. So we've been messing up in our relationship with Krishna for a very long time, nityabhata, practically speaking, forever. And therefore it takes some time. It takes some time for Krishna to trust us and reveal to us himself and ourself. And it takes some time also for us to have the faith and the trust and the courage to let go of the false ego. Ahankara ashrita, as Krishna said, we've been accustomed to taking shelter of the false ego, although it's hurt us. It's something like, you know, persons who stay in an abusive relationship or in some, you know, the Stockholm syndrome where the kidnapped person starts to identify with their kidnappers. and starts to see them as a kind of shelter. So we've done this with our ahankara and our lust, kama shrita, ahankara shrita, that we see them as a kind of shelter. It's I know it. It's something that's known. You know, if I leave it, well, what will happen? I'll jump into the unknown, and who knows what I will have. So therefore, it takes perseverance. We take a little jump, and we see, wow, that's nice. And we take a little bit more jump, and so forth and so on. So we want you to take this penance in perseverance. We may not have perseverance every minute of every day, especially at the beginning. It will go up and down. Our determination will not be steady up and down. It will go up and down. But eventually we have to have firm determination in the mode of goodness, not affected by success or failure. We should note carefully that this perseverance cannot be simply a matter of what we call willpower. The power of will in each of us is very limited. It's something like muscle power, and there's a certain point at which it becomes exhausted. If we do penance based on willpower, it will not last. It will not last. So our perseverance needs to be more and more and more as we progress, because we have some love and affection and attraction for Krishna. When we do, our penance does not feel like penance. We have, again, this experience in our ordinary life. I think we can safely say that all of us have gone through much penance and austerity out of love and affection, and it doesn't feel like that. In fact, it feels satisfying. You work hard for someone you love, something you love, some mission you love, and you feel satisfied, you feel fulfilled. I'm in the middle of reading a book about people called, actually the second book on the topic, people called multipliers, compared to people called diminishers. The diminishers go into a situation, everyone thinks, oh, they're so smart, and they try to control everything. And the multipliers, they go into a situation to make everybody else feel smart. And the research was showing that if your boss is a diminisher, you're only using 20 to 40% of your talent and energy. But if your boss is a multiplier, people will not only say I'm using 100%, they'll say I'm giving 150%. They'll exceed what they think is their capacity. And even more interesting, although they may become physically tired, they feel energized. They feel fulfilled. So even though they're giving 150%, they feel fulfilled. So when what's pushing our perseverance is love, is excitement, is adventure, is attachment, then our penance stops feeling like penance. As Krishna says, everything merges at transcendence, the 424, the person who's offering what they're offering, the consummation, everything becomes Brahman. Brahmano hi pratistaham amritasya vyastita shasvatasya tadharmasya sukasya ikantikasticha, which is the basis of all happiness. So you can't even distinguish anymore. Myself, what I'm offering, the result, the consumer of what I'm offering, it's all blissful, it's all sukha, it's all wonderful. I don't distinguish between the joy of cooking and the joy of eating. They're both joy. The joy of preparing for the festival, the joy of participating in the festival, it all becomes joy. So that it's essential to understand that this penance and perseverance should be on the level of bhakti. So this is what we want to search for. Who am I? Where did I come from? And we want to search for it with loving penance, with loving perseverance. Then we will gain true realization, which will lead to right action, which will lead to the result that we want, which is ultimately Satchitananda. We want a sense of eternity, a sense of knowing and understanding, and a sense of bliss. And that will be our own, as George Harrison said, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. That will be our own ultimate proof that I have found who I am. You know, even materially, when we are in a situation that fits with our material personality and abilities in a greater whole that we consider has some meaning, we have a sense of rightness, shall we say. We have a sense, I fit. This is the right place. I'm in my environment. I'm in the right place for me. So if that's true even on the platform of illusion, just imagine how true that is on the ultimate platform. The more and more and more that we find our real place, the more and more and more that everything just fits. Oh, yes, yes, this is right. And we have that immediate experience ourselves. We don't need confirmation from others. We don't need anything from it. It's self-evident. So questions, comments?
I don't know. I get the feeling that willpower is worthless.
Not worthless, but a very limited value. It's just like Srila Prabhupada says that you need bala, strength, but it's not muscular strength. So in a similar way, it's not mental strength. Like, what are the attributes of the subtle body? Thinking, feeling, and willing. So it's not that our spiritual life has to be based on muscular strength. We're not going to say, you know, the way you're going to make advancement is you work physically really hard. And in the same way, it's not a question of working mentally really hard. Now, there, you know, we do use our physical muscles in Krishna service, yukta vairagya, undoubtedly, and we do use our mental muscles in Krishna service, but that isn't exactly our means, nor do we depend on that. If you think about, you know, physical muscles, so if you're dependent on physical muscles for doing service, what do you do if you get injured or sick? Then, you know, you can't use your physical muscles anymore. You're lying in bed. You're in a wheelchair. Does that mean you can't do any service? And in the same way with mental muscles. Our physical muscles have their limit. You can only grow them so big. You can only get so much strength. They have an upper limit. If ever anyone goes above the limit, people say they must be taking some drug, because the human body has a limit. And it has a limit in endurance also. You know, you can only exert muscle power for some time. Then you have to replenish. You have to eat. You have to sleep. You have to, right? You can't just keep going on muscle power. And it's the same way with mental power. Exactly the same way. So if you try to use mental willpower, there's a limit to it. There's an absolute limit, like there's an absolute limit to physical mental muscle power. There's a limit to it in force, and there's a limit to it in duration, and you have to replenish it. Now, you can build it up. You can build up your mental willpower, just like you can build up your physical muscle power. The more you exercise your physical muscles, the stronger you get, again, up to that limit, and the more you exercise your mental willpower, just like Prabhupada would sometimes say, you get more determination by performing austerity. So that's a very simple principle, that as you perform austerity, you get better and better at it. I mean, a very simple example is if a person does a complete fast in Nirjala every Ekadasi. So the first time they do it is really hard. The second time they do it is hard. The tenth time they do it is easy. By doing the austerity on a regular basis, they've built up their mental willpower. However, that's not the kind of perseverance we are talking about, because it has its limits. And a person who's relying on that, when the limit is exhausted, they'll have some sort of a fall down to replenish their energy. They won't be able to be steady in success or failure, in happiness and distress. They just won't be able to. There'll be certain circumstances in which their willpower will just become exhausted. And you know, I just can't do it anymore. I need a break. I need to go eat some sugar, or I need to, you know, space out on something, and it just won't work. So a lot of times when devotees fail in keeping a vow, whether it's a big vow like no illicit sex or a little vow like no pragalpa, it's because they're relying on willpower. But that's not ultimately what it gives us perseverance. It just isn't. The kind of things that we will persevere in and not fall down in ever, under any circumstances, are based on love and connection. Those things give us ultimate determination that does not break under any circumstances. And the more there's love and the more there's connection, the more we have that perseverance. If you think about it, like if you're taking care of a little child, you know, no matter how angry you get at that child, you're still going to take care of that child. That's not willpower. You may use willpower sometimes. You know, the other day, while we were eating dinner, the two-year-old vomited all over the furniture and the floor. And, you know, his father cleaned it up. I'm sure that required willpower. But to take care of the child on a regular basis, if you're only relying on willpower, then you'll neglect or hurt the child sometimes. So the perseverance is coming from something else.
So you're saying it's really love rather than willpower.
Absolutely. When something's based on love, let's just give a real simple example, which I hope everybody can relate to this. If each of us can think of something that's been a permanent change in our life, I think the simplest is if we've gone from meat eating to being vegetarian. But anything where there's been a permanent change with absolutely no possibility of reverting. I mean, of course, there's always a possibility because we have free will. But for all intents and purposes, we wouldn't consider reverting. Something we did that we no longer do, or something we didn't do that now we do, that it's just, this is what we do. And it's become like breathing for us. It's become part of our life, but it wasn't always. It wasn't always. So what was it that allowed us to have that kind of commitment, that kind of perseverance, that I'm going to do this or not do this for the rest of my life, and it becomes just an integrated part of our life that we don't even have to give it willpower. We don't have to give it that energy to maintain it. Very, very, either no energy or very minimal energy. And we'll find in all those cases there was some strong emotional connection component. Like they say, people who are vegetarian for health reasons are not usually absolutely vegetarian. That's the research. People who are vegetarian for their health will sometimes eat meat. Whereas people who are vegetarian for ethical reasons are usually strict vegetarian. Why? The motive is different. The motive is some connection with the animals. You know, I mean, if we think of what are the things that we've kept, and for each of us it'll be something different. And even very difficult vows are easy to keep in those sort of situations. They're easy. You know, occasionally they may require some willpower, but rarely and to a very small extent. I mean, you know, I know somebody in their youthful days that decided that no matter how angry I am, I'm always going to speak the truth. And they made that decision because they saw that lying when angry had long-term effect on relationships. And they were able to keep that determination. You know, generally, when we're angry, we lie. We say, I don't care about you. Just get out of here. I wish you would leave. I'm going to leave. You're a terrible person. You've always been a terrible person. I've always been a wonderful person, and you've always been a terrible person. You know, it's just lies. I'll never do this with you again. I hate you. You know, and then the other person always wonders, what's the real truth, right? You say to somebody, I hate you. I wish I'd never met you. I wish you'd go away. I'm never going to do this with you again. You're always criticizing me. You're always doing this. And when the anger's gone, the other person says, oh, I wonder if the anger opened up truthfulness in them. I wonder if they're lying to me when they're not angry and they're truthful when they're angry. Right? It's very tempting to lie when you're angry. But it can be given up. Now, you can't give it up just by willpower. You just can't say, okay, I'm going to make sure I'm always truthful when I'm angry. But if you get this feeling, this emotion, that, wow, I'm really, I'm really hurting myself. I'm really hurting my relationship with this person. I'm really damaging something. You know, why am I damaging something? It's like I'm cutting myself. You know? Then you won't do it, no matter how angry you are. Whatever it may be. You know, I'm sure that all of us, you know, no matter how hungry we are, we're not going to eat meat. We're not going to eat cows. We'd rather die. And that, it's not willpower. Is that clear?
Yes, I think so. I think that what you're trying to say is it's more the positive thing. Like, we really have to learn how to love Krishna, I guess, rather than relying on willpower to advance in our Krishna consciousness.
Yes, it's what tool are you using? I think a lot of people get frustrated with following the rules of bhakti because they're trying to do it with the wrong tool. It's like if you're trying to pound in a nail with a screwdriver. And you know, if one is using just force of will, it'll work to some extent for some time, but it can't be the main means. It's all right. You know, willpower is good to some extent for short periods of time in very difficult situations, but to rely on that as the main means of advancing, one will fail.
What is the right tool?
The right tool is empathy and connection and love, caring. You could say through revelation. You know, when I get it, what we talk about realizations, or the Christians say epiphanies, when I get it, when the light turns on and I go, wow! Doing this thing or not doing this thing is killing me. And we actually feel it. We see it. It's crystal clear, like the sun. I mean, and again, a material example. I have a friend who has celiac disease. She can't eat any gluten at all. She has to do all of her own cooking. I mean, being gluten-free is a fad, but she really has celiac disease. She's gotten all the tests done and all that. And she was saying if she just eats, like, you know, a few grains of gluten, then she's sick for a day. She's vomiting and diarrhea, and she can't get out of bed. So it's not willpower that's keeping her on her diet. It's not willpower. It's an actual experience, pratyakshavagamanadharmam. In that case, it's a, you know, a caring for my own self. It's a connection with my own self. But Krishna says we should relish and rejoice in the self. So when we get that realization that, wow, when I do this or don't do this, it's killing me. It's killing others around me. It's destroying me. When we factually see that, then keeping the determination is easy. It's like breathing. And whatever penance is involved to do it, we gradually, we naturally do it. Okay, Harsh is asking how the role and identity are different and how are they linked. I am a husband, my identity, my role. Identity creates the role. I am a husband. What does a good... We don't just say, what does a husband do? We say, what does a good husband do? And it's usually more than that. It's usually, I am an Indian husband, or I am an Australian husband. You know, I'm a young Australian husband who is a liberal. It's a little more complex than I am a husband. I am a traditional, conservative, patriarchal Amish husband. Or I am a liberal, modern, feminist, Californian husband. You know, it's going to be different. If I'm a liberal, modern, Californian husband, then I'm going to make sure that I do as many of the child care and housework as much as my wife does. I'm going to try to split it 50-50. Right? If I'm a patriarchal, conservative, Amish husband, then I'm going to say, okay, these are my wife's jobs, these are my jobs. My role is determined by my role is completely determined by my identity. What I do day to day, 100%. determined by my identity. But identity is not just one thing, it's complex. So I have a different role as a young husband as I have as an older husband. My role as a husband to a devotee wife is different from my role as a husband to a non-devotee wife. That's also different. What my role is to my mother if she's a devotee is different than my role to my mother if she's not a devotee. I am the daughter of a devotee mother. Oh, that's different than I am the daughter to a non-devotee mother. The role becomes somewhat differently defined. Ultimately, we want to say, I am Krishna's servant. I am Guru's servant. And part of my service is to play this role in a way that Krishna will smile. If I think, you know, I am a conservative South Indian Brahmin husband, then I want the other South Indian conservative Brahmins to smile. I want them to nod and say, yes, 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 you are following the norms of our community. We will give you status and position. But if I'm a servant of Krishna, who's given the temporary service of being a husband to this particular person, then I'm going to think, what will make Krishna smile? Now, that might be, some of there will be overlapping. Right? And some of it will be different. I'm a servant of Krishna who has a temporary role of taking care of this child. It's very different from, you know, I'm a British parent who has the role of taking care of this child. It's not the same thing. And one is my identity and one is a temporary service within my identity. You know, it may be as part of my job that I may do some sales from now and then, but that doesn't mean I'm a salesperson. I hope that's clear. We could take one more.
You spoke earlier about the voice in the sky, or the game that the children would play. You're getting warmer, you're getting colder. So for a devotee on the path of self-realization, how do we know for certain we're getting warmer, we're getting cooler?
Oh, what a very good question. Well, we have Sadhu Shastra Guru. So we all, it's a big circle. Prabhupada says Krishna is not narrow or stereotype. It's a big circle, but whatever we're doing, we should be able to find support for that from Sadhu Shastra Guru, without contradicting other parts of Sadhu Shastra Guru. It shouldn't be selective. Well, that means we have to know the Shastra, we have to study the instructions of Guru, we have to associate with saintly persons. We can't expect just the, you know, Akashvani, the voice from the sky. You know, it might happen, you never know. But I don't think we can expect that. So we should have enough knowledge. We have to read Prabhupada's books. We have to read the books of the Acharyas, sing the songs of the Acharyas, meditate on them, associate with more advanced devotees in our daily lives. And believe me, we will get that you are getting warmer and you are getting colder. Happens to us all the time when we do that. You know, I'm working on Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha with Bhaktivinoda Thakur's commentary and also commentary of contemporary Vaishnavas. And, you know, you read that and it's really clear. You read things and they jump out at you. I mean, I was reading something in Satchinanda Maharaj's commentary as I was going through and editing it, where he said there's only room for one person on the throne of the heart. Is it the ego or Krishna? And it jumped out. The sentence jumped out of the page at me. Who's on the throne of your heart? You know, I think we all have this experience. We're hearing something from a lecture from Prabhupada, or reading something in a purport, or, you know, and something jumps out at us. And it can be positive or negative. I mean, I had an instance many, many years ago. I was reading something in newly translated purports in the 10th canto of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, and all of a sudden, you know, an aspect of Krishna's pastimes, a very specific aspect of Krishna's pastimes, became clear to me in a way that it hadn't previously. I'm like, wow! And I was so excited, so I went to talk to one of my devotee friends about it and said, look at this, look what Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur was saying here. Oh, wow, this is so clear. And this other devotee said, that's not right. That's not right at all. You're not understanding it properly. And I thought, well, maybe this devotee's right. Maybe I'm not understanding it properly. And the devotee said, look, Prabhupada says this, and Prabhupada says that, and Prabhupada says this, and Prabhupada says that. And I became a little despondent because my realization had been so exciting. And it opened so many doors. It had given me such happiness. And then I went through a day where I was sort of sad and disappointed. And I prayed to Srila Prabhupada. I said, you know, please show me what is the actual situation here. And then I was just listening to a lecture, and Prabhupada clearly, so clearly, confirmed what I had read from Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. And I started then searching through Prabhupada's books and lectures and conversations, and I found that Srila Prabhupada said apparently to what it seemed to be two contradictory things, but when you put them all together, you got a complete picture. And in the complete picture, I went, oh. So I think we all have, any of us who spend time with the acharyas, with the shastra, we continually have this experience if we let sadhu, shastra, and guru correct us. If we're open to being corrected by them. I had a very strange interchange a few weeks ago. There was a devotee who was posting videos of a 1960s pop singer and saying that it was me singing feminist songs. And a lot of people were believing it, and I was getting letters from people, you know, it's so sorry that you're being criticized for something you did in the past. And I said, well, it wasn't me. You know, that's not me. I would have just been a little child of seven at the time, and there was a 25-year-old singer. You know, it wasn't me. So generally, I just ignore these things, but I was getting so many letters from people offering kind of their condolences that I finally wrote to the person who is the supposed guru of the person who was creating these videos. So the person creating these videos says, yes, so-and-so is my guru. So I wrote to that guru, and I said, you know, I'm not sure if your disciple will listen to you, but he's posting these false videos of me. And people are getting upset by them. I keep getting letters over and over again every day. So the guru said, well, this disciple doesn't usually listen, but I'll try writing him. So he wrote him. And the so-called disciple wrote back, both to the guru and to me, and said, I don't listen to anybody. Right out, he said, I don't listen to anybody. I mean, the guru had written to him. He said, actually, you know, I've been receiving complaints about this for the last 2 months from many people. He said, I didn't bother doing anything about it because I figured you wouldn't listen anyway. Now that Ermi was writing me also, I'm writing you, but I know no one can orchestrate you. And the so-called disciple wrote back, he said, you're right, no one can orchestrate me. And he made a whole list. He said, you know, not this authority, not that authority, not that. He had a whole list of all these people who couldn't tell him what to do. He said, I decide whatever I'm going to do. So then that's hopeless. If one reads the scriptures, if one listens to the guru, listens to the sadhu, but we already have our preconceived notions and nobody can tell us what to do, then we won't get this warmer, colder. Then everything is just based on our own mind. This makes me feel good. So the other evidence is what makes us feel good, but it's got to be sadhu, shastra, guru first, and not select quotes. Because this guy was taking select quotes from Srila Prabhupada to justify his behavior. He was devil-citing shastra. He was, you know, he was doing that. But he wasn't taking a comprehensive view. He wasn't allowing himself to be corrected. So once we've got that down, once we're taking a comprehensive view, once we're allowing ourselves to be corrected, and we're drinking regularly, Pabantiye Bhagavata Atmanasatam, we're drinking the Sadhu Shastra Guru regularly, then we can rely on Pratyaksha Bhagamam Dhamyam Susukam Kartamavriya. How do I feel? Am I getting closer to what's my Pratyaksha? What's my experience? Because then we rely on the Dharman and the Sukham. Dharma is our essence. Am I feeling closer to my essence? Am I feeling closer to joy? And the more we advance in Krishna consciousness, the more Pratyaksha Bhagavam Dharmam Susukam Kartamamyam becomes our evidence procedure for us. Like Maharaj Yudhisthira said, I know Draupadi can marry all of us because I never have an adharmic thought. And this thought has come to my mind. Wow. You know, I couldn't say that. I couldn't say, well, my thoughts are evidence. But as we progress in Krishna consciousness, yes, our thoughts and our feelings are themselves evidence. But
in, nice.
You know, so is that all right? But we've got to be careful that we're in Sadhu Shastra Guru. And, oh, believe me, Krishna will correct us. He will. He has, if we are open, any good teacher will. Come on, like a student who wants to learn, why won't Krishna? Why won't Krishna do it? Of course he will. Okay, thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada.
Thank you, Haribol.